Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Embryonic stem cell research and human rights are on the agenda for Joan Lewis this week. First, however, Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett look at Jesus who calmed the storm in this Sunday's Gospel.
One day, as evening drew on, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us cross over to the farther shore." Leaving the crowd, they took him away in the boat in which he was sitting, while the other boats accompanied him. It happened that a bad squall blew up. The waves were breaking over the boat, and it began to ship water badly. Jesus was in the stern through it all, sound asleep on a cushion. They finally woke him and said to him, "Teacher, doesn't it matter to you that we're going to drown?" He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Quiet, be still." The wind fell off and everything grew calm. Then he said to them, "Why are you so terrified? Why are you lacking in faith?" A great awe overcame them at this. They kept saying to one another, "Who can this be that the wind and the sea obey him?"
Just when he fell asleep, we don't know. But if we're to go by Mark's account, and Mark is ghostwriter for Peter, who was there, we know that Jesus had been teaching all day.
Again he began to teach by the lakeside, but such a huge crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat and sat there. The people were all along the shore at the water's edge. He taught them many things in parables.
Although, as usual, the evangelist doesn't waste time on prosaic details, Mark does suggest that there were times during the day when Jesus and his disciples were left alone. People must have gone home to eat, for they were not in open country, as on the occasion of the feeding of the 5,000. The fishing town of Capernaum was nearby. And during those brief pauses we read, "The 12, together with the others who formed his company, asked what the parables meant. And he explained everything to the disciples when they were alone." But the crowds kept coming, and as the day wore on and he began to feel the strain, Jesus must have realized that he would have to go away, because the people obviously were not going to. He'd given them enough food for thought, quite enough for one day. On other occasions, Jesus would probably have gone back to Peter's house, which was in the town. But how could they hope to get through that multitude? You can almost hear the disciples saying it. But Jesus needs no telling. And when he says, "Let us cross over to the other side," no one protests. And as the Jerusalem Bible version puts it, leaving the crowd behind, they took him just as he was in the boat. A delightful escape it might have seemed to the disciples. But it was more a case of out of the frying pan into the fire. The other side of the Sea of Galilee was the southeastern side, and from Capernaum it meant crossing the whole lake diagonally. If we consider that it's 13 miles long and at its widest part 7 miles across, it was not exactly a short trip. Piero Bargellini calls it a little cruise, but suggests that it would have taken them all night. "So they put to sea," writes Luke, "and with a number of other boats, crammed with disciples who didn't want to be left behind, and with sails set and a north wind, the little fleet is on its way. Jesus, who will not be needed for navigation, settles down in the stern and is soon fast asleep. But without warning," writes Luke, "a storm broke over the lake." And this, explains traveller H.V. Morton, is one of the peculiarities of the Lake of Galilee.
Sudden storms swoop swiftly over this low-lying sheet of water, whipping the surface of the lake with fury and covering it with waves that frequently swamp the small rowing boats. The reason is that winds from the west, passing over the highlands, come swirling down through 100 gorges and narrow valleys into the deep pit in which the lake lies. The water is smooth one moment, and the next it's a raging sea in which men battle for life. It was one of these storms that is described so vividly in the Gospels.
Though the boat Jesus and the apostles were in was not a small rowing boat, but a sturdy fishing vessel, the wind, we're told, was gale force. And in no time at all, the waves are breaking over the boat, which begins to ship water. The waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already filling. The waves were breaking into the boat so that it was almost swamped. And thereby hangs a tale. In the National Gallery in London, there's a painting by Turner of 1803, representing Calais Pier. In referring to this painting, an art critic comments,
"The wildly turbulent scene is anything but accidental. At that time, a seascape painter was expected to make his observations directly by or on the water. Turner fashioned the scene presented in Calais Pier from his own experiences while landing in Calais on his first journey to the continent. The relevant scene is to be found in his sketchbook, together with the comment, 'nearly swamped.'"
The artist may not have been involved in a storm on that occasion, but the ferries of his time had no such things as stabilisers, and to be swamped was probably a fairly common experience. But Turner painted many seascapes, and one recorded a snowstorm at sea when he was on board ship. He wrote himself,
"I did not paint it to be understood, but I wished to show what such a scene was like. I got the sailors to lash me to the mast. To observe it, I was lashed for 4 hours, and I did not expect to escape, but I felt bound to record it, if I did."
Many have been the storms at sea recorded in writing. St. Paul himself was shipwrecked 3 times, the most famous of which was recorded by St. Luke, who was with him. Paul had warned that the voyage would be dangerous, but his words went unheeded. And so?
"It was not long before a hurricane, the northeaster as they call it, burst on them from across the island. The ship was caught and could not be turned head on to the wind, so we had to give way to it and let ourselves be driven. For a number of days both the sun and the stars were invisible, and the storm raged unabated until at last we gave up all hope of surviving."
But survive they did, as we know, though the ship broke up, and they found themselves on the island we know today as Malta. Fishermen and their families have always had a great respect for the sea and never underestimate its destructive power. When living for a while in the Aran Islands off the west coast of Ireland, the dramatist John Millington Synge was waiting one day to go out in a curragh with the local fishermen. But the weather was uncertain, and he quoted later the words of the father of one of the fishermen. "The old man gave me his view of the use of fear."
"A man who is not afraid of the sea will soon be drowned," he said, "for he will be going out on a day he shouldn't. But we do be afraid of the sea, and we do only be drowned now and again."
In his drama, Riders to the Sea, Synge drew on his experience of Aran and its fisherfolk. Moria, the heroine, is an old woman now, and is mourning the last of her 6 sons, all lost to the sea. "They're all gone now, and there isn't anything more the sea can do to me. I'll have no call now to be up crying and praying when the wind breaks from the south, and you can hear the surf as in the west, making a great stir with the 2 noises, and they hitting one on the other. I'll have no call now to be going down and getting holy water in the dark nights, and I won't care what way the sea is when the other women will be keening. It isn't that I haven't prayed to the Almighty God. It isn't that I haven't said prayers in the dark night till you wouldn't know what I'd be saying. But it's a great rest I'll have now, and it's time, surely. They're all together this time, and the end is come. No man at all can be living forever, and we must be satisfied." In his book on the Aran Islands, Synge writes of passing a line of stone pillars with crosses above them and inscriptions asking a prayer for the soul of the person they commemorated. "I remember seeing these standing stones when I visited Inishmore, the largest of the Aran Islands, some 90 years after Synge. And in the little cemetery I saw that the sea had taken many of the islanders." As defined in the dictionary under sea, the Sea of Galilee is only a small freshwater lake. But its storms, sometimes called lake quakes, are violent enough to instill fear into the heart of the most experienced sailor, as the Gospel shows. One can imagine the frantic activity of the men, trying to keep the boat on its course, bailing out, shouting to each other above the roar of the waters and the howling of the wind. And the Master sleeps on through it all. Sailors, of course, don't want landlubbers around when they're battling with a storm. In the opening scene of Shakespeare's The Tempest, there's a lively exchange between the boatswain and the king and his courtiers, who are getting in the way.
"Keep below, you mar our labour. Keep your cabins, you do assist the storm."
"But there is royalty aboard," murmurs Gonzalo, the old counsellor. The sailor is unmoved.
"What care these roarers for the name of king? To cabin, silence, trouble us not. You're a counsellor. If you can command these elements to silence, we will not hand a rope more. Use your authority. If you cannot, give thanks you have lived so long, and make yourselves ready in your cabin for the mischance of the hour, if it do hap."
In our Gospel case, of course, the sleeping passenger is not hindering the men trying to keep the boat afloat. But the situation worsens, and they decide to waken Jesus. And somehow we can hear the desperation in their voices. As Sheed puts it,
"The words they used come down to us through the centuries, with all their humanity still warm in them. Don't you care if we all drown?"
No one was prepared for what happened next. The disciples were not expecting a miracle. They wanted Jesus to share in their trouble, and surely to warn him of the danger. After all, they were sinking. They may have held out a slight hope that he could do something, but what? Command the wind and the sea? Dominion over the waters is one of the characteristics of God in the Old Testament, the scholars tell us, and divine intervention in human affairs is often presented in images of a storm. In the book of Job we read, "Then from the heart of the tempest Yahweh gave Job his answers." As for the waters, we're told, they are the symbol of evil, and so
the stilling of the storm by Jesus becomes not only a sign of his lordship over creation, but also over evil. The raging waters of the sea and the storm are the negative symbols which are opposed to being and to life. That is why Jesus rebukes the wind, almost as if it were a person, and therefore Satan.
He then rebukes the disciples for their lack of faith. And remembering the old man of Aaron, we might wonder that Jesus should ask, "Why are you so terrified?" But the fear our old man was advising was a fear born of respect, of knowledge, resulting in prudence, which, after all, is a Christian virtue. The Gospel account ends with the great awe which overcomes the disciples, and their amazement that someone who appears to be a man like themselves, as he is, should perform an action only possible to God. There's a celebrated story known to all English schoolchildren of a man named Canute, who, at the beginning of the 11th century, became the first Danish king of all England. The legend runs that Canute placed his chair in the path of the oncoming tide, which, in his arrogance, he thought he could turn back. In reality, we read,
"He had himself seated at the water's edge, not to prove that he could command the waves to roll back, but to demonstrate to flattering courtiers that he could not, that even a king must accept limits to his authority."
Canute knew, as we do, that time and tide wait for no man. I wonder, did he ever read the Gospels? And now let's listen to these lines from the old hymn which sailors regard as especially their own. The second verse refers specifically to our Gospel.
"Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea. O Christ, whose voice the waters heard and hushed their raging at thy word, who walkst on the foaming deep and calm amidst its rage did sleep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea."
In the August of 1941, the English Prime Minister Winston Churchill and the American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt were on the deck of a Royal Navy battleship, which was rolling in an Atlantic swell off the Newfoundland coast. They had just signed the Atlantic Charter, and immediately the sailors' voices rose in chorus. If sailors have always been superstitious, they have also relied heavily on prayer, especially in moments of danger or when confronted with the unknown. When Magellan's ships stood west into the waters of the Pacific Ocean, writes one, they were making a leap in the dark such as no mariners had ever attempted before in the history of the world. And so we read, crucifixes were raised and the chanting of the Te Deum drowned the cries of the seabirds. Today's sailors are probably somewhat less outwardly religious. But the sea is still a challenging element. It still commands respect. And a sailor of today might murmur in his heart a prayer something like this poem by Hilaire Belloc, In a Boat.
Lady, lady, upon heaven height, above the harsh morning in the mere light, above the spindrift and above the snow, where no seas tumble and no winds blow. The twisting tides and the perilous sands upon all sides are in your holy hands. The wind harries and the cold kills, but I see your chapel over far hills. My body is frozen, my soul is afraid. Stretch out your hands to me, mother and maid. Mother of Christ and mother of me, save me alive from the howl of the sea. If you will mother me till I grow old, I will hang in your chapel a ship of pure gold.
Now Joan Lewis and I will wander through the Vatican's activities this week. Joan, another week and a quiet one for audiences.
It really was. If you look at the Pope's public schedule, very, very few audiences, public speeches, etc. We certainly always have the Wednesday General Audience and the Sunday Angelus. There are events. There's news coming out of the Vatican. There's statements, declarations, positions here and in Geneva on quite a number of matters. But the Pope's schedule has been quiet.
The week after next, he is traveling. We can be expecting to hear things about the family.
Oh, definitely. When he's in Valencia, his schedule was made available not that many days ago. And it's really kind of funny. It's like everybody in the world has known for quite some time, many, many months, that he's going to Valencia. Certainly, the Bishop of Valencia and Pontifical Council and people have been talking about it. And it's like, well, the trip is only official when the Vatican Press Office releases the schedule of the Pope. And which they did recently. So he'll be there just for a weekend, July 8th and 9th. And we want to look forward to, we want to be very careful about listening to him. Everybody who's listening to us should kind of perk up their ears the weekend of the 8th and 9th of July, because it's kind of expected the Holy Father is going to talk about a number of very important issues, which more or less are threats to the family today, to human life and to the family. Obviously, the question of same-sex marriage. You have him going to Spain, where the leftist-leaning Prime Minister Zapatero, his government, approved same-sex marriages. I think he did it something like 2 days before the Pope took office, if you will, last year. Anyway, so there's a lot of threats, even coming out of the government, if you will, in the country that's hosting the conference. But another issue I think we can expect the Pope to talk about in that milieu is the question, for example, on June 15th, you have the European Community that had voted to fund research that would effectively destroy human embryos, research on embryos and embryonic stem cell research. And then, of course, within minutes, maybe because they were expecting it, the COMIS, the Commission of Bishops Conferences of the European Community, came out with a statement through their spokesperson, the Secretary General, Monsignor Treanor, Noel Treanor. And obviously they condemned this vote because it's totally the opposite of what the church teaches. That would be destroying life if you destroy an embryo. And so a very strong statement came out by the bishops on this, condemning this vote where the union wanted to go. And then in days after that, you had individual bishops making their positions known. You also had the Osservatore Romano, of course, is the Vatican newspaper. In a weekend edition, it criticized the vote taken by the European Parliament to budget funds for this. And the newspaper said such research is, quote, forgetting the tragedies of the 20th century. And all we have to do is think of Auschwitz, of the terrible, terrible medical experiments that were done on human beings who were live, fully developed human beings, and also on embryos. And on this same question, of course, of the research, the Bishop Elio Sgrecce, who's president of the Pontifical Academy for Life, he made a reference to Italy's Law 40, that's the name of the law, which bans experimentation on human embryos. And he noted the ambiguity of the Italian position in the European Parliament. And he asked, what can the attitude be when the decision of Parliament will need to go to the European Council, where the current Italian government has withdrawn the ban sanctioned by the referendum? And, of course, in Italy, for those who don't know it, the stem cell research is prohibited. So certainly any move in that direction to overturn that ban or allow such research would receive strong criticism, as it rightly should, from the Vatican, from the Holy Father. So when you mentioned earlier the family, I think that the meeting in Valencia certainly is going to hear some strong words on that. And that may not be the only milieu in which we will hear strong words. But in other news this week, this is one of the Pope's meetings. We were talking about it being a quiet kind of private meeting, quiet public week. The Pope on June 17th did meet Jan Eliasson, the president of the UN General Assembly. And in a statement, we know what their talk was about. It lasted about 25 minutes because Press Office Director Navarro Valls gave an indication that in this meeting, Benedict stressed the need to give consideration to religions in the process of globalization and the need for religious values in promoting peace and human rights.
And our question for this week is, we believe as Catholics what is written in Paul's letters and in the Gospels. Are there actual documents left behind for us?
This was a fascinating question from a gentleman named Dick Keating, and he got this from the website, which, for those of you who can hear me and are having trouble finding the website to get the address to write questions, get a pen. The address, email address, is joanknows@gmail.com. Anyway, to answer Dick Keating, there are several original copies. I have seen several in the Vatican. The ones I saw, I think, were all written by St. Peter. And I think his first and second letter, they're in a room that is never, ever seen by visitors. These are the treasures of the treasures of mankind, the priest who showed me this room and these documents told me. But how do we know that this is really true, that somebody just didn't sit down centuries afterwards and write these wonderful books about this amazing man called Jesus Christ? Well, interestingly enough, Biblical scholars, and I am not, I should say that right away, of course, I am not a biblical scholar. So, Dick, you might want to talk to your pastor. Ask him to talk about this some Sunday. When he's giving a homily on the gospel, ask him to perhaps explain to people, you know, yes, there are a few originals. Yes, we have copies of copies. But tests have been done over the years by biblical scholars. There's three tests in particular, one called the bibliographical test, assessed by counting the number of manuscripts that we have for an ancient text, so a copy of a copy, and so forth, and the time span between one copy and the original, bibliographical. Internal test checks the internal consistency of an ancient document. Does it contradict itself within the very same document? Is the information consistent with itself? And then the external test is, this checks with other historically known data by which we can, by which people can verify the information from the ancient text. So if you have copies of copies of copies even, and yet they basically all say the same thing, they use the same person's name, they talk about the Beatitudes and they give the same number, whatever it may be, if there's this consistency, you know it's inspired word of God. And in the case of some of the Gospels, you may have the Gospel of Mark, people say was written between 50 and 60 AD. There are others who might say 70. That's a very small difference in time. If somebody had said it was actually written in 300, well, then you'd have a huge discrepancy. So you have all of these factors coming together, and that's how we know with some certainty. And this is a terribly short and incomplete answer to a question that has many, many thousands of people around the world who have studied this for years and written extremely good books and taught extremely good courses.
Well, not only that, the tests that are applied to these writings are identically the same tests that are applied to any ancient document
Oh, the Iliad, yes, exactly. Yes. It does not have to be a biblical test. And you're absolutely right. So any document
from... It's standard archaeological science.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So those tests are applied, not only the ones I was mentioning, the internal, the external, the bibliographical, they are indeed applied to other texts. So just to take one of the more well-known cases, you've got the Iliad, and you've got maybe copies of copies with a several hundred year span between the so-called original or first copy and the last copy. But then you've got them all side by side, and they're practically identical. So does
of
that
course.
Verify
so
it? Yes.
You've got the scripture scholars, but you've also got archaeologists and
sure.
other scientists on the job as well. So there's a pretty fair body of
confirming evidence.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Hmm. Great question, and do keep them coming. joknows@gmail.com.
You have been listening to Jill Bevilacqua, Sean Patrick Lovett, Joan Lewis, and to me, Sister Janet Ferns. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure through the internet, by going to the main Vatican Radio website at vaticanradio.org. Click on English and you'll find us. You will also find us in the archive in the category headed Culture and Society. Until we meet again, may God bless you.